everyone right, and beginning to visit with Debbie this Wednesday morning, is it? The 6th of September, 72. Channel One Right on this new reel, and the beginning of the visit with Debbie all by herself with Faye this Wednesday morning, the 6th of September, 72. Channel One Right and beginning the visit with Debbie this Wednesday morning, the 6th of September, 72. Channel One Right and beginning the visit with Debbie this Wednesday morning, the 6th of September, 72.
Instruments, I guess. Different kinds of recorders, and then the long instrument that comes up and turns. It's like a bent recorder. And the high one? It's like a bassoon. It has a double reed, and it's thin and down, and then has a sort of bulbous part on the bottom. Now that's something else too.
I have to look at my little list. I'm not as there's the flugelhorn. I mean, that's the flute.
The flute
and various kinds of what's my favorite? Well, anyway, one of the things that he does that's interesting, the group gives little programs, and then they talk about the instrument. And he goes, "Oh, this is one of the outstanding Renaissance groups." He started it here, and you find a lot of Baroque groups. You don't find the Renaissance groups. And he goes around to the Renaissance societies and plays, and then he got to where they play for weddings.
Mm-hmm.
And they play for teas and, you know, getting.
Well, I was just so impressed. I think that it's the nicest wedding I've ever been to, just for the music. Just because they had a harpsichord and then the four people playing different instruments. And
he has about a dozen people in the ensemble.
Oh, really?
And they all play.
They alternate playing?
They can almost all play any instrument.
Well, they're all passive, aren't they?
Yes. But they are majoring in music, and usually in some of them have taken up this particular these instruments as their majors. And some of them, but anyway, they pass the instruments around, and it's quite difficult to play some of them.
Yes, I would think so. Well, it's difficult enough just to play a recorder. I think we have a recorder, and that's awfully hard
to really play.
To really play it. You know, I can play Mary Had a Little Lamb on it, but nothing else.
I can't right now bring the names of the most interesting ones to mind. I have the one horn that's particularly interesting to me because it's very much like a French horn. I mean, it doesn't look like it, but it sounds like it, and it has this woody. But I think the tone is so interesting. You know, it's very, very, very nice. All of them are when they've got them together. And of course, he's had several grants
just to study
Study the Renaissance instruments, and also they to buy some. And the group itself owns a number of those instruments, and then some are borrowed from museums and things like that. And their aim is to have enough paying jobs to purchase their own instruments.
Went to go away, which I thought was sort of nice. You know, they brought their music stand out, and they played a little dance as she went out. So that was real nice.
And he was pleased to hear the grandfather.
Oh yes, I think he liked it. The only people that didn't like the music were the two grandmothers, the great aunt and the grandmother from Louisiana, and they missed the organ. They missed the "Here Comes the Bride," but everyone else liked it. It was just unusual.
Well, he almost got here before you did. He almost got back to the States as soon as you did.
He came back about. When did he come? The 18th, I guess, of August, something like that. A couple weeks before the wedding. And he's going to stay now until November, or the end of October, he'll be here. Then he's going back to Germany for the winter. He wants to have snow and sit in the winter garden. He was telling me that they have the porch in the back of the house is the winter, they call it the winter garden, I guess in German that's another word for an enclosed porch, and it's all full of flowers and plants, and I guess he's got he has a cactus garden. He moves it inside.
Well, hello.
A cactus garden. He has it outside now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in the wintertime he must move it inside into the winter garden. And he said that they sit in the winter garden when the snow's outside and they have all the plants inside. And they sit and watch it snow. He likes that. So he wants to go back. He told me he liked to spend winters in Germany because it wasn't cold enough for him in Florida. He didn't get enough snow. He preferred it in Germany. Mm-hmm. He's been working so hard since he's been over here. He's been working in their garden, in their yard.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have gardens in America. But he's just completely renovated their yard since he's been here. He's working all the time in the yard.
What are you talking about? Headliner?
German. Mm-hmm. Industrious. Saying that the people that played at his granddaughter's wedding were German, so he got to speak German to them.
Wow.
He's very pleased. I think he was a little amazed at how elaborate American weddings are. He had a friend there who was also German, and Otto, what's his last name? I just remember it was Otto. He's a German man who lives here in town. And he came up to us after the wedding and said that this was really quite a wedding, wasn't it? You know, the long dresses and everything. And they'd never seen anything like that in Germany. And Fadi told me that he didn't understand why the wedding was so formal, but it took such a short time. In Germany, the weddings take an hour. This wedding was over in 10 minutes, and they were all dressed up, and it was over in 10 minutes.
I often think that, too.
I know. It didn't take any time at all. He said, you know, in Germany, they go to church for a while.
That's right.
They're going to have a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I kept following him around at the reception. I wanted him to be sure to do everything like throw rice, and he didn't know how to throw rice. So I dragged him away from the musicians and told him he had to come throw rice. Because that was part of an American wedding, and he had to see it.
After all that.
Oh, time. You give him a tip of time.
That's right. Told him he couldn't miss it. I even gave him rice. I got him some rice and gave it to him.
Yeah.
I don't think he threw it, though. I'm pulling it too much.
Well, he's been over here before, though, hasn't he?
Yes, he comes every year, just about. He misses some years, but he usually comes for a couple of months every year.
Oh, that long.
He doesn't like it in Florida very much, though. He says he feels he's in prison when he comes to America. He's very confined when he's here, and when he's in Germany, he has... The trolley stops in front of his house, and he can get around, and he doesn't have to depend on people, and he feels that his life is sort of his own, whereas when he comes here, he has to sort of stay and be at the beck and call of someone's big car to take him around, so he doesn't like it as much, I don't think.
That's right.
Says the houses are always air conditioned, and you can't open the window and have the air come in. And you can't sit outside because of the bugs. He doesn't like it too much here. He tried to move over here. He was going to move to America, He stayed about a year, I guess, after his wife died about 10 years ago, and he came over, 12 years ago, I guess, and he came over and was going to live with Sigrid and Shaw. And he tried it for a year and just didn't like it. And so went back to Germany. So he couldn't change.
I never thought of that. Well, they have an inner urban going right by your house almost everywhere. You know, you can walk a little ways and get on one, can't you?
Yes. That's right. Every 15 minutes.
Yeah. All through the countryside.
It's such a lack here.
I dreamed last night about, or night full last sometime, about that, about, you know, it came from what we had been talking about, that there ought to be, on any road, there ought to be a section for the slow traffic. People to walk, or to, you can't even walk, you see, on the highways.
Mm-hmm.
Anymore.
You can hardly drive 35 miles an hour.
Yeah. You can't bike without risking your life. And the slow traffic ought to have as much rights as the fast.
Mm-hmm.
Golly.
That would be a great big difference, wouldn't it? And his garden, where he could stay out.
He works all the time in his garden. Well, he works here outside, too. I'll never forget the first time I ever met him. I guess it was 12 years ago when he first came over, and he made a garden in the back of their yard, and it was just beautiful. He had these little rows of carrots. I mean, the rows were no longer than this. It was a tiny, tiny garden, but it was just beautiful. It was like a little jewel, these rows of carrots and rows of onions and rows of cucumbers, and just beautifully tended. I mean, the earth was practically hand-smoothed. It was so beautiful. And his garden is like that in Germany, too, now. It's just, he loves to work outside. He loves plants, and he knows so much about them. We went over to see them after the wedding, went next door, and they showed us one of Sigrid's kumquat trees. Finally had fruit on it. They'd had it for years, and it had never bloomed. And so Fadi said, well, you know why? Because last year I took up the grass, and I put fertilizer on it. And that's why it's blooming this year. That's why it bloomed, and that's why it's got fruit. That's so cute. And Sigrid just looked at him and she said, that was last year you did that? He said, yes. He just knows how to, even over here where the plants are utterly different. There are all these fruit trees and blooming flowers and things they don't have in Germany. He knows how to take care of them. Just amazing. And he never grew up on a farm. He was an urban person. His father was a furniture salesman, and he grew up in towns. He never lived on a farm. Yet, I guess everyone in Germany just has gardens in their yard, and that's where he learned how to do it. They just use every bit of space in their yard for growing something, instead of having a lot of grass and hibiscus bushes, I guess. they don't waste space. They don't have it to waste.
Looks like we could have some of that, doesn't it?
Well, it takes all your time. You have to devote your energy somewhere. He spends all his time working in the garden. And that's why it's so productive. I mean, if you were doing anything else, you just couldn't. Plants need a lot of attention. You gotta water them and weed them, and it's like anything else. It's like a horse.
The minister, if he had a garden like that, wouldn't have many parish duties, would he?
I know.
Maybe they haven't assumed too many parish duties. They just haven't. Debbie, let me tell you. You suspect more than is true that I know so much or like that about all these things. I don't know much. Just very little bit. And you know, but what I found is a very little bit will make a great deal of difference. Now you see, Suzanne has got so she comes in and she don't pay a bit of attention to me. She has something on her mind and she sits down and reports. And she'll go for an hour or two. All we do is listen. That's all there is to it. See? But I just go along with them. I learned that from the countryside. None of the educated people know it anymore. It's like your gardening, you see? All of us used to be gardeners. I was brought up in vegetable gardens and flower gardens. I spent my time growing up getting the crabgrass out of the flowers and everything else. You see, it's a radical change over here. The children don't even know about it. Now, Rick, going back to South North Carolina to see his grandmother, they go back every summer for a few days. His parents and all of them go meet up there. And he was just alive with expectation. He thought for the first time now he'd be able to see his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get out of himself, you see. He's not even projecting now. That simple. I mean, nothing magical about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just something you do all the time. And he's even taking his typewriter. He's going to take his typewriter. And if he can type with his unmental family, they're all bright, you know, and educated, but they're not mental in this sense of the word. That'll be an accomplishment.
He kept shaking his head last night, Stan. He wished he'd been able to look and listen to all those times he'd spent up there. She lives on the farm. All those years he spent up there.
Yeah, she's still in the old, lives in the old manor. I guess
yeah.
She at least as much as she can.
And the whole family goes.
I take it, I haven't heard him talk about it. I take it as a family reunion.
Yeah, his father called to make the arrangements.
I learned it from the from them. Now, just little by little, and you know, when you're faced with another world, it's right there, and you're looking at it. You still can't see what it is. Willie Chitty used to come over here and help me. He'd do the work, and I'd help him. He put this soundproof ceiling on. It turned out I didn't need it, but he put it on.
God, if they put it on just any old way, he wouldn't do it.
Yeah. He used to show up at the oddest times. We were out there about this time of the morning, and there he showed up, and something happened about poison oak, and I started telling him about poison oak. Boy, he picked up poison oak, and he told me things I'd never dreamed of. From this little place up there off the Cutoff, Williston Cutoff, where his brother
was the best businessman, the only really one in his family, his brother. And he's building a house there. And they were working in Portsmouth there and other places. And he'd seen it bloom and all. And even the remedies for it. I just had to quit and listen to him. Now what it was, you see, he wasn't smart, but he had that old manner. He lives in his experience, and he looks at it, he examines it, he can talk about it. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were writing the letters, I kept saying, now, Debbie can't write about this. She's looked at it, but she doesn't have control of it. Like your looking at the Gothic. You didn't actually see it. Now, what it is, you see, the awareness belongs to the old generation, and he probably does that, his culture. He learns it from his culture. Willie learns it from his culture. Willie's just a country boy, you see. That's his mother you heard in there, mm-hmm. that long, mm-hmm. slow stuff. And that's what we're leaving. That's what Faulkner has. And you have the, you see, I've been working in the Hamlet. I hadn't used the Good on Moses. I hadn't read the little piece on Uncle Hubert when he was in his prime. But you see, it's not possible for me to think of that as fiction anymore. Uh-huh. It simply has to be experience. It's something that Faulkner has seen, or really, those things didn't come from being there, it came from reporting. I don't have to see the Havana in his garden as long as you report on it. You see, children grow up, they don't have any experience of their own, and still they know by heart what's in people's kitchens, even though they haven't been in there. They hear the parents talk, or they used to, and the parents don't talk anymore. So now you have to do it in a scholarly way. You have to learn what they grew up in. Now that's all.
You know how my sister, Frances, we always say, well, she remembers things that happened before she was born. And she said, I was there. I know I was there. I can remember it. This is the
just from hearing
it. Just from hearing it, it's so real.
Yeah.
And she does.
You see in the one of Faulkner's I worked in, the Hamlet, you know, where Flynn is, where Ratcliffe is in. And you see, in the first part of it, you see the Snopes taking over the village. And it's you see, it's just something that you can't make up. But now I'm not scholarly enough, and Ratliff, you see, Ratliff does this. And Faulkner tells you how Ratliff does. He tells you little, he can't tell you too much, he wouldn't tell you too much, and some things he doesn't know. You have to assume that in reading a writer. And not give him more credit than he possess. Now you see, all the writers now are learned. Their novels are all abstract and plant. You see, the Faulkner's just falls out. That's the way it ought to be. One of the lectures I heard on it sort of gave all the connections that Faulkner left out. And I thought to myself, Faulkner left it loose. Why don't he? I want it tied up. Well, I may be quibbling, you see. But he's making a learned novelist of Faulkner. But Radcliffe, you see, he does some of the finest reporting, except Faulkner won't do like Mark Twain with Huckleberry Finn, you see. And Twain keeps Huck all the way through, and he's a perfect nuisance. He don't need him. And Faulkner just picks up Radcliffe whenever he wants him.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, you say I'm being technical about it. I'm not technical about it. I don't know anything about writing or Faulkner or fiction. And all I know is what I learned from Willie. And Radcliffe talks like Willie. Well, one nice thing that what Faulkner suggests, he contradicts it. He's a sewing machine. He sells sewing machines 2 or 3 a year. Well, what he's suggesting is, I'd say, at least to me, is that Radcliffe is not really interested in sewing machines. If Faulkner says, where you see him is in crossroads stores, where the wash pot's going, and on verandas in the heat of the day, that's where people sort of get together. And now you see him, his finest narrative is on the veranda of the hotel, you know, after dark or dusk. A few of them happen to stroll in. That's a remarkable. That's one of the most beautiful things I ever saw. But it's just stuck in, and then he forgets about it, goes off and leaves it. Isn't that nice? And then another place, you see, Radcliffe sells some medicine machines. He can't finance them, and he's just about to go bankrupt. So you don't have to be consistent. One place you can do one thing, one another. I've never seen any of the people I work with recognize any of this themselves. They get a lot out of it, but what they get out of it is not there, a great deal of it. They come out of a Snopes novel and say that he represents all this bad. Well, you ought to specify something. He's dishonest. He's tricky. Well, and he represents the forces of evil taking over, you see, a good culture. Well, it wasn't a good culture. You see, old Varner was a scalawag. And you see what happened at Houston. So, and Faulkner doesn't know what the forces of evil are. There's simply no way of his knowing. He got the same faculties as we have. I don't know. Surely. I think the worst thing about Snopes is that he doesn't talk. And in that world, that's where people came to life, in their talk. And the worst thing I think you can say about our times is that the talk is sort of Freudian. People are sort of pricking at each other all the time. It's not comfortable talk. Or it's meaningless talk. Now the talk I hear, you see, the people that I've learned from have been like the one Faulkner puts in. We could go over to Miss Guthrie's right now and she'll talk to you just like Faulkner. She'll make those enormous statements. Worse than Emily Dickinson. Miss Shirley was over here the other morning, Friday. She is in town.
Debbie came back with me. We saw Shirley.
Yeah.
In the car.
She'd had the boys down at McIntosh getting a haircut. She stopped by here, said, just drop in and see me. She didn't stop to see me. She wanted to see Pappy. She just foolish about that bull. He's the prettiest thing she ever saw. Well, you see, I manipulated her. I said, Shirley, I need to get my breath. See, I hadn't been out of the house. Sit down, catch your breath a minute. That's the only talk we have in here. You can't talk outdoors. She's a great talker. She can talk. And she and Berman both. I don't know how they learned it, but they do it. Well, towards the end, I sort of play them off one against the other. Shirley and Ms. Guthrie. Ms. Guthrie's the elderly, you see. Shirley's gone. I said, I'm sorry. It looks like Ms. Guthrie still got that land she wanted to sell for $600 an acre. Oh, yes, she says, but she wasn't interested in the land. And then she leaned over. She said, I'll tell you. And she gave me this long report. She says, she called me the other day, and she says, Ms. Dodd, I'm going to sell every last cow I've got. And what she does is make an enormous statement like that. And then the extraordinary pause and the silence, and you're supposed to ask her what it's all about. You see? She says, my cow's got out in Mr. Hamilton's garden and just ruined it, and he's going to sue me. Well, if Shirley is short of cows, she got more pasture now, and she can't buy them. They cost too much. She talked it over with Berman. Said she thought she'd just make an offer for about 20 of those cows. And she said this fella down the road there needed 25. She might just buy 25 more and then let him have those. And then she says, no, if I make $5 on it, it'll be the end of my friendship with Ms. Guthrie. Well, she called back that afternoon. Marvin answered the phone, and she told him, and he said, well, we're not quite so interested in selling the cows now. He says it wasn't but one cow that got out. And she got out way over on this side, and she kept walking around looking for a hole in the fence where she could get back in, and she just walked through Mr. Hamilton's garden. Shirley has just talked with Miss Gussie for the hour, and she's heard one enormous statement like that after another, and she still wants to believe it. That's part of the old world. You can't make it a normal statement anymore. If I were to, I did it without thinking to a bunch of freshmen one time, second time freshmen. I've been working out here, and I went in and I said some of the things, you know, those are normal statements. See, the normal statements, they are interesting. It's a whole lot nicer to speak. You see, when you talk about head one, you wouldn't do it, but I would. Or Miss Guthrie would. She'd make some normal statement about him, and then she'd go ahead and tell you all about him. She'd talk just like you do. But she can't take a plain prose attitude towards him. Something there has got to get into it and lift her spirit.
Even people who know Guy well and know that this, you know, is making a statement, this enormous statement. So. Doesn't mean that that's what he believes. And they know that. And yet, the other day, we were right out there, and we had several people who come out here a lot, who know Guy. Guy said, these big farms didn't need all those paling fences, those wooden fences. So I forget the enormity of your statement, but it was, and you didn't say it was a disgrace, but you said it.
Well, they need one plank of it.
Yeah.
That'll keep the horses in.
And you said they didn't need all those planks. They just need one plank, that'd keep the horses in. And he said it in that great big way, you know, and that opened it up, and everybody out there just jumped into the thing, and all sorts of reasons why they were beautiful and
why keep the ponies in, they said.
Wouldn't keep the ponies in, and you've just never heard such prosaic things in your life. And Guy's statement just went up in the air, you know. It was surprised me was I thought in his words they'd go along with him and see what he meant. He, you know, he wasn't you know, this is what, I guess, for want of knowing something better to say, we say this is town talk. Because Miss Gussie would have had the biggest time in the world with that. Or would it? He wouldn't have thought that was an outlandish statement.
That's where I learned it. I didn't learn it from the scholars. They talk from experience, and they examine the experience. And then, you know, they differ. Some of them, like Miss Mary, you see, will have these enormous statements, just like Emily Dickinson has. Not all of them.
And they're all circumstantial.
Oh, yes.
They never say he's a fine fella. They just give you a circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little impatient with people who make general statements, sort of knowing.
Abstractions You can't work from abstraction with them. And that comes from the educators.
Mm-hmm.
And these days, see, the educated are cut off from experience. It's all abstract. They don't even see experience anymore. And you see, the thing that you've done, I guess it's just your stars that's enabled you to do it. You didn't know to do it. Like Barbara got off on horses, Barbara Long. And she was spared a whole lot of that education. She's just a fabulous talker. I mean, she don't know it all like that. But she is. She talked about England in a way that I never heard anyone talk. And all she did was work on a horse farm. She never hardly got out of it. Some nights they went over to the tavern or to the pub.
And Barbara couldn't even stand inside the pub. It all made her sick.
Too much smoke and noise.
Stand outside.
Well, you see, you've been able to circulate and not get trapped, caught. And now I'm going to tell you what I want you to do. I've talked to you a good bit. You talk to me now. your world. You see, I'm pretty limited in the number of people I can make contact with, and what I can talk to them about. Now you have a huge world of people. You just
I have too many. I know too many people. I would love to know all the people out here too. I don't even know if I could talk to them though. I was just thinking coming out here that I haven't even been in school in 3 years and I'm the worst little MLA scholar there ever was. Like you were saying the other day, I'm awful. And I haven't even been in a school. It's just terrible. How strong your upbringing is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Just awful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had it all, I had it for 22 years, I guess that's why. But I got, I never knew very many country people in New England. There are.
That's the world I know. You get into your world. People you know.
People I know. Well,
I say God just mentioned the people of the countryside because that's the way that it enabled him to see what the writers were writing about. But there are other ways. He doesn't say that you need to know the people of the countryside, particularly.
Uh-huh. So the people that I used to work with. Up in Boston, we were kind of an amazing group. We all got along so well together. Marion was the one I think I told you about her one time. She used to be the crime reporter for one of the little papers up in Maine, and then she went out to California and worked out there for a while, and then she's back in Boston now because she had a stroke, and so she's back working at Tufts now.
At her age?
She's 50.
Oh, is she?
I guess. Yeah.
Oh, yes, you mentioned her.
But she's just done so much, and it's hard to get through to her sometimes because she's a little bit scatterbrained now. You have to talk to her a long time before she talks about what she's done, but she's had such a fascinating life. She's done a lot of things, and she doesn't just bombard you with it right away. You know, she makes you work a little bit to get it. And then John, that I used to work with, worked for 45 years for UPI. He used to be a staff writer for UPI. And he used to talk about doing the night shifts and covering things. They had a round-the-clock staff turning out articles. And he used to work the night shift at night, go in and work from midnight to 4 writing. Or he'd have to work Sundays and cover things like football games, which isn't too interesting. But he'd have to work 24 hours a day getting things out. And I just never even thought that, of course, people who put out newspapers have to work all night long, too. It's not just working 8 to 5, which is what most people think. You know, go home at 5 o'clock and that's the end of the day.
Yeah. But now, your method, you see, in pursuing something. See, I tossed you the ball, and Suzanne learned it to carry it. And it's very simple, very simple. Now, here's a little statement that will carry you through it. You see, you just go anywhere you want to, and it's just like the fellow I used to know did in the hot weather. You see, he wouldn't walk across that sunshine. He'd go way around from shade tree to shade tree. Now that's what you do.
Instead of walking through the sun.
From your, you won't let me finish. From your, she's been conversational like her friend now. You see, I'm pursuing a subject. That's what people do. They pick up the wrong thing. You see, you can go from one of your friends to another one of your friends, or from your mother's friends, or somebody else's friends. Everywhere you go, and just pick up as if you've never left off. Now, I made the statement for you. It's not true necessarily, but it sends you on your way. Go ahead.
Hey, Debbie.
So you're not in school?
I never got out of school. I told you I never got out of school. I feel like that little filly walking down the... That's just what I'm like, you know. I'm just like that little filly falling all over, can't walk on a halter. Oh, there's just so much going on, you know. You can't keep up with all of it when there's so much going on. Every time I turn around,
yeah,
something new.
Yeah. Hold it to it.
Well, even all over Europe.
Don't let her wiggle out.
You did this. And I made that statement. You know, from one.
Isn't that right?
All around the outside of the field instead of going straight through it.
No. I'm talking about your friends. That is, you can go.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, it's a little oasis where you have contacts.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We went from. That's right. The whole time this summer, I wasn't anywhere where I wasn't with someone that I knew. Because when we were in the Loire Valley, we were with people that we knew there. And then
well, specify it. I don't care about abstract.
I was with a girl that I went to college with,
there.
And she married a French boy, and they were living in Nevers.
Well, make them come alive. I want to see them.
Well, he was. She did the same thing that I did in Nice. She took the same course, and I wrote to her. My friend Russ, who's from New York, and
yeah.
She's sort of a wild sort of girl with a lot of curly hair like this. She's got afro hair. Very, very, very curly. And she's from Hazelhurst, Mississippi. She grew up on a cattle ranch in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, which is the county seat. And if you want to hear somebody read Faulkner, you should hear her read Faulkner. She said her whole family is just right out of Faulkner. She had, her grandmother is a tyrant of a southern aristocracy. And their whole family is just completely dominated by this grandmother. She runs everybody's life, and she lives in a big white house up on the hill in the ranch, and the entire family lives on the ranch with her. She's got two daughters, and she managed to drive off the husband of one daughter, but the other husband stuck around, but nobody thinks he's any count for us. And she runs all the grandchildren, and she runs both her daughters, and I've never met her, but I can see her sitting up in that house, and she's got it now. She's got a big dog because she's afraid of the niggers coming up on the hill. So she's got a big dog that's so mean that nobody can go up there. Got this huge German Shepherd dog that's a mean watchdog to bite anybody that comes up. And so not only none of the niggers can come up there, but none of the family can go up now anymore either unless they call and tell Grandma that they're coming first. And Russ's mother runs the ranch now for her. I guess I heard she's divorced. And Russ has never talked about her parents being divorced, but I gather that the grandmother ran him off because she didn't think he was good enough for her daughter. And so Russ's mother is the foreman of the ranch now, and she runs the ranch for the grandmother, but the grandmother is the one that is controlling everything, and the woman must be 75 now. But she's the last of a dynasty. So Russ wrote to me, and she said that we had this friend, this girl that we had both gone to college with, who was living in Nevers, France, which is in the Loire Valley. And she said, let's go see Dee and Claude. Well, since we're going to be in France, I'd like to see them. It's been 3 years since we've seen them. And so I wrote to Dee, and I said, Dee, I'm in Nice, and Russ is coming over, and we'd like to come see you if we could on our way up to Paris. And so she wrote back, and she said that, lo and behold, she had done exactly the same thing that I had done in Nice. She'd taken the same course, and she wanted to know what I was doing in Nice because she left. She said she left, and was I at the university? Was I doing a licence, or what was I doing? And that please come to see her. And on the way, I wasn't supposed to lose Russell in any of the old towns that we went to. That I better be careful because I might lose her. And so we. We got up to Nevers. She wrote to us again. She said, just come anytime, that the door would be open. But they didn't have a car, so we'd have to walk around or ride their bicycles. They had three bicycles, and we could get around on those. So we wrote to her from Corsica, and we told her when we were coming. But of course, there was a postal strike, so the postcard never got off the island. Another one of France's postal strikes, and. We got there, and we expected her to be there at the station waiting with the bicycles, and she wasn't. And so we decided, well, we'd better take a cab, because she said that it was pretty far up the hill. So, and we had some suitcases and stuff. We didn't know where it was, and so we thought we took a cab to her house and just sort of knocked on the door, and they didn't know we were coming. They never got our postcard. So they had welcomed us right into the house, and her husband is... He's a fonctionnaire for the government in Nevers. He's just this skinny, skinny, skinny French boy. He's about this big around. He's just the tiniest thing I've ever seen. And Dee's project now is to try to get him fattened up. She's feeding him an American diet so he'll get fat. Because she says he's got a terrible French liver and he can't eat anything. He just gets sick. Because he's been eating rich French food all his life, and it's just destroyed his liver. Yeah, can't do it. And he's the one that came home from work at 10 o'clock because they were on strike from 10 to 12. He couldn't speak a word of English, and he Well, he could speak. He understood a little bit. He couldn't understand Dee because she had a southern accent. She was from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and she had a little bit of a southern accent. But she also, she just speaks strangely. She has strange sort of speech, kind of chews her words up when she talks, and so he can't understand her very well. And Russ couldn't speak any French, and so the two of them would sit down, and Dee and I'd walk out of the room and just leave them to sort of talk at each other in French with a southern accent and English with no kind of accent at all. Poor Claude. He came over right before they were married. He came over to meet her family and in Winston-Salem, and the people that lived next door had two little girls who were 10 years old and 9 years old, and they used to tease him because he couldn't speak English. They just teased him all the time, told him, what's this you're talking, what kind of language are you talking? And they upset him so much that he won't speak English now. But they met up in Grenoble. She went from Nice to Grenoble. She didn't like Nice, so she went up there and did the next 2 degrees after the one that I did. And she met him there. And then he wanted to be a port person. I guess I told you that. He wanted to be a port manager and run ports. He'd done a pre-law degree. And then when they told us that they were living in Nevers, we thought that was pretty strange because there were no ports in Nevers. It's right in the middle of France. And the Unals told me when they found out that they were living in Nevers, they said that Nevers is like the most bourgeois place in France. But when French writers write about France, they say that Nevers is where all the little fat bourgeois Frenchmen are walking around with six little children tagging along behind them. Middle class France. But we liked it. We thought it was really pretty, and we ate artichokes there. It was artichoke season, and artichokes were about this big. You ever seen an artichoke? It's like a little basketball. I have a picture of it because we cooked them. We had to cook each one in a different pot. They were so big. They were just enormous, and that was all we'd eat for dinner would be an artichoke. It's a huge, enormous artichoke. You ever see an artichoke so big you couldn't put it in? And they ate the stems, too. The stems about this
big. Well, you get so whenever you talk, you don't have to start out with one, but you'll just gravitate in some direction. That is, you're making some sort of statement about these people over there. You just kind of work into it in a casual way. Now, you see, I don't see a direction now, and I look for it. It's the direction, actually, that makes it live. It's not the artichokes. It's the direction that what you're saying. I don't exactly care about this little girl from Mississippi so much as I do. You see, all these worlds you can enter means a great deal more to me than this little 2 or 4 down here in Mississippi. She may be worthwhile, may not. But that's not as interesting as your statement. It's your direction. You don't have to say it in a mechanical way. You just kind of, you know, it's there. Now that's what I learned from the countryside. Because you see, I make statements all the time. Everything I say is a statement, and that's lamentable. I can talk without it, but you wouldn't recognize me.
I probably wouldn't.
If I did. They're little statements, just very mild statements, you see. And there, you see, what you do, You'd have to work with me or Suzanne or somebody. Yeah, but I work with me. I mean, talk and write a little bit. Writing doesn't help you unless you can disengage. Just a little short writing, I don't think is useful. I don't think so. I think you have to live it over just as long as you can. You've got a day, live it the whole damn day. If you don't, if you got a week, live it the whole week. But you're living in that world. And you exclude the others while you're hardly doing it. So you bring it to life. You have to talk from what's in your mind. And you see these little statements. You see, you can watch them. One thing about them is they don't need to be true, just so they're truthful. Well, there are a lot of little things you can say about them. Statement of doubt is much more interesting than the other sort, you see. You're so off on this thing. It doesn't mean you're against it, but what you're trying to do is cut through so you won't be bound by the conventional thing. You can get into it on your own. A lot of little things, you see. I've worked out enough methods, you see, that would help you. I was a little bit sad that you couldn't pick up a little of that, you see, before you went off on this last jaunt. It enabled you to see so much better. You see, you have to see with the ceases. You have to deliberately look. Or you get so you don't deliberately look. But it's always a strategy. I can really think some little poems, you see. All of them, as Charles Anderson said, a strategy for singing.
Else experience just becomes experience, raw experience.
Yeah.
And
raw.
And
yes.
Like going to a movie, seeing for that. It isn't part of it. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be what Richard Ryan and Suzanne.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's
from what
you see, the intellectual about it, it's just something you learn from Jessica. She's not smart. Well, now you see, you keep looking at me, keep going. What you ought to do is you don't want much of me, just a little time. So,
yeah, I don't want much. She did something very nice. She picked
up
the girl, you know, as soon as you knew that Jack,
yeah.
You know, it's amazing.